ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world right now is a disaster. It's easy to feel helpless. But there was a moment when millions of people around the world said enough. I'm Sisong Kim Simong. Join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid, how Australians joined others around the world to push back against racism and won.
Whites-only teams, we thought that to the average Australian, that would be despicable.
Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The pilots at this Air Force base in eastern Taiwan say in the past couple of weeks they've never been busier. They train here, they sleep here, and if Chinese Air Force jets come near Taiwan...
The Taiwanese people have lived under the threat of invasion for decades. China's dictator Xi Jinping has instructed the vast Chinese military to be ready to invade the island by 2027. That may not happen, of course, but it could. So 2026 may well be Taiwan's last year as a free, self-governing democracy. Now, in response to continuing Chinese aggression, Taiwan's democratically elected leader, Lai Ching-te, recently announced a significant boost in military spending and plans for a new air defence system. Donald Trump has said he doesn't believe China will invade Taiwan. But late last year, in a telephone conversation with the US President, Xi Jinping restated his position that Taiwan belongs to China. An idea which many Taiwanese flatly reject.
China want to swallow Taiwan. Like they think Taiwan is part of China. We say no to China.
I think those people, they think that it's not the time to wait. We have to do something. And it's also the time to tell the international community that we don't want to be part of China. We want to be individual in an independent country. And the name should be Taiwan.
Hello and welcome to Rear Vision. I'm Anthony Fennell. Donald Trump and Xi Jinping are set for fresh talks in Beijing in a few weeks' time. Those talks were to have been held at the end of this month. But Donald Trump, weighed down by war in the Middle East, well, he asked for a later date. When those talks do occur, they'll be about trade and tariffs primarily. But it's understood that China's president will ensure that Taiwan's future is also on the agenda. Just a few days ago, former US National Security Advisor John Bolton warned that Taiwan was particularly at risk because Beijing may now sense that the US is too distracted or militarily stretched to come to Taiwan's aid in the event of a surprise invasion. Today on Rear Vision, we'll look at the justification Beijing uses for wanting to claim its tiny neighbour. And we'll also ask whether Donald Trump's recent military operations could make it easier for Beijing to justify an attack on Taiwan. But before we do, here's a reality check, a historical one, from Dr. Andrew Phillips at the University of Queensland.
I think it's important to keep in mind there is a dissonance between the historical truth and the power of the Taiwan narrative for Chinese nationalism. So if you were to ask any Chinese person about Taiwan, they would be very clear to say that it has always been an integral part of the Chinese motherland. The reality, however, is that this was described once by a Chinese emperor as a ball of mud. It was ruled by China as a directly administered territorial province for only 10 years, from 1885 through to Japan's conquest and seizure of Taiwan in 1895. It is therefore something that is totemic in its significance for Chinese nationalism, but also inflated in its historical importance as an eternal part of the Chinese motherland.
Andrew Phillips from the University of Queensland, and we'll return to him later. Now, the Chinese Communist Party justifies its claim to Taiwan based on what it calls its One China principle. But what does One China actually mean? The simple answer is that it's complicated. And to make sense of it, we first have to journey back more than seven decades to the dying days of the Chinese Civil War, fought between the notoriously corrupt nationalist government and the insurgent communists.
Nanking, capital of China, awaits the entry of the Red Armies. These are its last days before its expected fall. On the great Yangtze River, which links Nanking with Shanghai, gunboats stand guard as thousands of nationalist troops are ferried to defend the capital, although all signs point to its surrender.
That was in April 1949. Within months, Chiang Kai-shek and his surviving nationalists had fled to Taiwan. Mao Zedong had declared the People's Republic, the PRC. And the world suddenly had two rival Chinese governments. After withdrawing to tiny Taiwan, the nationalists who had ruled China since the end of the Qing Empire were exhausted and depleted. So why didn't the communists on the mainland seize the initiative and simply overrun them? Dr. Mark Harrison, senior lecturer in Chinese studies at the University of Tasmania.
In 1949, they were preparing to. And in 1950, the United States, in January of that year, President Truman made a statement that he would not intervene in the final resolution of the Chinese Civil War. And then on June the 25th, 1950, North Korea invaded South Korea, and on June the 27th, President Truman made another statement that he would send the 7th Fleet into the Taiwan Straits and prevent either the Chinese communists attacking Taiwan or indeed the Chinese nationalists attacking mainland China. So it was actually the outbreak of the Korean War is the critical moment that created the conditions for the division between the People's Republic of China and the Republic of China.
Despite the division, the sense that China should once again be whole was strong on both sides of the Taiwan Strait. Melbourne University's Dr. So Kee Tok says the notion of one China had significant cultural and historic resonance.
Repeated regimes from the Qing down to the nationalist government to the communist government, they have always seen China as one single whole. So the transition of China from the Qing dynasty to the nationalist government has seen the formation of the idea of a sacred territorial border that is sacrosanct to the Chinese nation. And when the Communist Party took over in 1949 and the nationalist government in mainland China retreated to Taiwan to form the current Taiwanese government, the idea of this uniting the entire whole remains very much on the agenda for everyone, which is why you see on both sides of the strait, okay, whether it's mainland side or the Taiwan side, the CCP government has always maintained the position that it will reunite Taiwan, whereas the Taiwanese nationalist government will say that they will retake mainland China.
Chinese nationalist troops before Chiang Kai-shek remind the world that although this offshore island is all the territory that remains to the man who once ruled the most populated nation on earth, he has never given up hope of wresting China back from communist rule. The cream of his 600,000-strong army celebrate the 46th anniversary of the revolt.
And so it went on for much of the Cold War. When the communists talked of one China, and specifically what became known as their One China principle, they meant the mainland and Taiwan one day coming together under Beijing's rule. But Chiang Kai-shek, the military dictator of Taiwan, believed the only real one China was one in which he and his nationalists were in control. Because Taiwan was anti-communist, it naturally became Washington's ally, and the PRC part of the Red Menace. But there was soon to be another complication added to the equation.
Good evening. I have requested this television time tonight to announce a major development in our efforts to build a lasting peace in the world. There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people.
In the Spirit of 76 taxis to a stop on the runway of the Peking Airport. And Premier Zhou Enlai moves forward to greet the first American president to set foot on Chinese soil. East meets west.
So from the late 1950s, it was actually very early, the United States was looking for ways and channels to communicate with Beijing. It was very clear by the 1960s and in the mid-1960s that Chiang Kai-shek's dream of returning to the mainland and re-establishing republican authority on the mainland was never going to be realized. And so the United States began to look for a more pragmatic basis for understanding its relations with the Chinese world, with both Taiwan and mainland China. It also came to understand the Sino-Soviet split in 1960, in which relations between the Soviet Union and the PRC broke down, and it saw an opportunity to leverage that breakdown and establish stronger ties with Beijing in order to marginalize the Soviet Union. So Henry Kissinger in the early 70s made secret visits to Beijing. In 1972, Richard Nixon famously visited Beijing and met Chairman Mao. And through the 1970s, the conditions were created for the final switch of recognition in which in 1979, when Washington de-recognized the Republic of China and closed its embassy and recognized the People's Republic of China and opened an embassy in Beijing.
But while it de-recognized Taiwan, the US reaffirmed its economic and military support for the island through the passage of the Taiwan Relations Act. Its highly pragmatic new approach to Chinese sovereignty then became enshrined in what, rather confusingly, became known as the US One China policy.
So the position statement is that the United States recognizes that the People's Republic of China is the sole legal government of China. However, it does not accept or does not state that it accepts that the People's Republic of China has sovereignty over Taiwan. The word that it uses is it acknowledges Beijing's position that it is the sovereign government of the island of Taiwan. So in the use of the word acknowledge, rather than recognize or accept or any stronger term, in the use of the word acknowledge is an ambiguity through which Washington and indeed other countries show that they understand Beijing's position, but also indicate that they will not take action that validates Beijing's position. So there's a very particular ambiguous use of language in the way these statements are framed.
And Dr. Harrison used the word statements there because there are, in fact, many One China policies.
So other countries, typically Western countries and U.S. allies, started to adopt a deliberately ambiguous stance per the United States. The Japan One China policy states that Japan fully understands and respects the stand of the government of the People's Republic of China. Canada takes note of this position of the Chinese government, and Australia acknowledges the position of the Chinese government. And if we dissect this language a bit further, it's noteworthy that Canada, Australia, and the United States do not clarify which Chinese government they're referencing, be it the PRC or the ROC, which adds an additional layer of ambiguity.
Jessica Drun, a Washington-based China and Taiwan analyst.
These One China policies allow these countries to have an official diplomatic relationship with China, an unofficial relationship with Taiwan, but they are allowed to define what this unofficial relationship entails.
And just to be clear, the One China principle that Beijing insists upon is a principle that says that there is only one China and that Beijing is in charge of both Taiwan and mainland China. But that's very different from the One China policies that were adopted by many Western countries, including the United States and Australia.
Yes. So the One China policies, and I'm glad you emphasized the plural, that it's multiple policies, are policies adopted by countries that formalize the country's stance on Taiwan and serves as a basis or part of the basis of how these countries interact with Taiwan. And it allows respective countries to formulate the scope of what their One China policy entails.
So it was United States in their Taiwan Affairs Act that make One China policy famous. And in fact, it was Kissinger who said that, you know, and Nixon that say, okay, we should have a One China policy. So at the end of it is that you can maintain whatever social, economic relations with one party, okay, but official diplomatic relations will always have to be residing in Beijing. That is the One China policy as we know today. It's all right for Taiwan to maintain cultural and economic affairs office around as an unofficial embassy or consulate for Taiwan, but it cannot elevate itself to diplomatic mission. Okay, you'll always be a cultural, economic exchange kind of arrangement. So in Canberra today, we have a People's Republic of China embassy, but we also have a Taiwan Economic and Cultural Exchange Office at the same time.
Taiwan acquiesced to the new reality because America had already made up its mind. And realistically, the US was Taiwan's only effective guarantee against a mainland invasion. And despite still clinging to its own strident and uncompromising One China principle, Beijing also saw benefit in the new pragmatic approach of the West.
Everything changed in the post-Mao period. The Chinese Communist Party, under the leadership of Deng Xiaoping, recognized that the kind of ultra-leftism of Maoism had led China to catastrophe through the Cultural Revolution. And Deng Xiaoping was always a much more pragmatic, ruthless but pragmatic leader. So under him, a wide range of policies were implemented, known as the open door and reform. And so the Chinese economy began to marketize. China had been very isolated up until the end of the Mao period. It became open to foreign investment, to travel, to tourism. And as a part of all of those changes, those absolutely thoroughgoing changes in how China was governed, the status of Taiwan was also assessed and reassessed.
In 1992, there was a consensus formed between Taiwan and Beijing. Tell us about that and what was meant to be achieved by that.
In 1992, there were talks between the two organizations that unofficially represent the two sides. So that's the Straits Exchange Foundation and the Association for Relations Across the Taiwan Straits. The leaders of those groups met in Singapore and had some discussions. The exact substance of those discussions remains very contested. In the mid-2000s, so around 2005, key figures in the Chinese Nationalist Party, the KMT, began to say that in those talks in Singapore in 1992, a consensus was reached, and that consensus should be the basis for improving relations between Taiwan and the People's Republic of China. The consensus is that both sides agreed that Taiwan is part of China, but both sides agreed to disagree on their respective definitions of China. It could be the Republic of China, it could be the People's Republic of China, but both sides agreed that they accepted that Taiwan was part of something called China. So they introduced this ambiguity into the meaning of China as a way of improving relations. The subtext of that, or the backstory for that, was that in 1982, Beijing had proposed one country, two systems as a formula under which Taiwan could become part of the People's Republic of China. That ultimately was applied to Hong Kong. The Taiwanese never accepted that. And so by the mid-2000s, policymakers were looking for alternatives. And so this notion of the so-called 1992 consensus was coined, making reference to this earlier event in Singapore. There are people in Taiwan who claim that there was never any such consensus. And certainly for this to have come from the KMT in the mid-2000s was very much about domestic politics in Taiwan, wanting to find a way to push back against the then Democratic Progressive Party government of Taiwan. So this phrase was invoked. When the Chinese Nationalists, or the KMT, came back into power in 2008, then it became an official policy on both sides through which relations were moved forward.
And you're listening to Rear Vision, an ABC Radio National production. I'm Anthony Fennell. Understanding the notion of One China, its history and contemporary relevance, particularly for the future of Taiwan. That's our focus today. The deliberate ambiguity created by the One China policies of the West kept the peace between Beijing and Taipei for many years. But then two things happened. Taiwan transformed itself from a dictatorship into a democracy, and then many years later, Xi Jinping became president of the PRC and began a more aggressive foreign policy, and talking up his commitment to one day achieve unification, even if necessary, by conflict.
All activities of splitting territory from the motherland will be opposed firmly by all Chinese people. We have firm will, sufficient confidence, and sufficient ability to defeat any form of Taiwan independence separatist plans.
So Beijing has been actively working to conflate its One China principle with countries' One China policies, to paint them as one and the same. When it releases statements critical of a country for crossing a line, and a line at that that is set by China on how it interacts with Taiwan, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or other officials out of China releases statements critical of the action as in violation of One China. These statements often do not distinguish between the two and use them interchangeably, but always under the framing of the One China principle.
So is the suggestion that Beijing is conflating the principle and Western policies around One China deliberately as a form of propaganda, as a form of manipulation?
I believe so. Given how ambiguous Western policies are, it's becoming increasingly difficult to understand as we get further away from the historic memory of when these policies were formulated. By painting the One China policies as the One China principle, this gives Beijing more legitimacy on the ground, at the same time limiting Taiwan's international space.
Can reunification happen in the future without armed conflict? Personally, I'm pessimistic. Why would I say that? It's because between China and Taiwan, there are huge differences in the way that they see the outlook. Very different. The two systems, they cannot be reconciled easily. That is one thing. And we have to take note of the growing Taiwanese identity in Taiwan. It is hard to perceive Taiwanese people wanting to have Beijing as their overlord nowadays, especially after they have tasted the fruits of democracy. We always avoid saying never, okay? Never say never, because there are so many variables to think about when it comes to the situation. But unless there had been a huge, drastic political change either in China or in Taiwan, or a total collapse of the economy of Taiwan, for example, you know, bar aside these kind of drastic developments, I find it hard to see that the two countries can reunite in a peaceful way.
So the domestic politics in both the People's Republic of China and in Taiwan are extremely significant for this issue. In Taiwan, it transitioned to a democracy at the end of the 1980s and through the early 1990s. And an opposition party, the Democratic Progressive Party, was founded in the mid-1980s and has become strong enough to win elections. It held the position of the presidency from 2000 to 2008. The KMT came back into power from 2008 to 2016. And the current government of Taiwan is a Democratic Progressive Party government. The politics and the ideology of the Democratic Progressive Party were formed during the authoritarian period, and they reach back much further to the 1920s and the very distinctive form of liberalism that emerged in Taiwan under Japanese colonial rule. And in that period, aspirations for self-determination were expressed by the people of Taiwan. And in current Taiwanese politics, those aspirations are very foundational. They have a very long history now, more than a century, and they form the ideological and policy core of the Democratic Progressive Party. So in the democracy era for Taiwan, aspirations for self-determination and for a status that recognizes Taiwan's distinctiveness and indeed its potential for nationhood in the international system have become key drivers of Taiwanese politics. The international system and the international community does not accept that, and that's a deeply frustrating problem for the people of Taiwan.
For Taiwanese-born academic Mei Fen Kuo, that frustration is personal. She now lives in Australia, but she grew up in Taiwan during the early years of the political transformation. One China, she says, is no longer of interest to her generation.
The end of martial law in Taiwan was in 1987, and from 1996, Taiwan has the first presidential election, and now Taiwan has democratic government. The new generation, they begin to have a different view about themselves, about their identity. In the last decade, the pressure from China also pushed the new generation to identify itself as a Taiwanese rather than Chinese. And also we see what happened in Hong Kong. This also is a very key factor for the Taiwanese to identify himself as a Taiwanese rather than the Chinese. The new generation in Taiwan, they had already have a very strong attitude to mainland China and really try to seek a new position about Taiwan.
Mei Feng Kuo. Now, as mentioned right at the beginning of this program, Xi Jinping is due to meet again with Donald Trump at a summit in China in a month or so. Taiwan, it's believed, has always been a talking point whenever the two have spoken in the past, and is likely to be so again. But since their last meeting in late 2025, much has changed. Most notably, the United States ignored international law and unilaterally took military action, first against Venezuela and now Iran.
The Iranian city of Tabriz under attack. The US and Israel striking targets across the country.
Today will be, yet again, our most intense day of strikes inside Iran. The most fighters, the most bombers, the most...
One question that analysts are now asking themselves is whether America's willingness and enthusiasm for launching military action against other sovereign countries, well, whether it's now set a precedent for an eventual Chinese attack on Taiwan.
I don't think it sets a precedent, but it does establish a permission structure. It is clear that Xi Jinping is heavily motivated to claim Taiwan under Chinese sovereignty. But if we're looking to the direct effect in terms of the policies of the United States, I think what it does is less provide an additional impetus of motivation and more provide a potential structure of legitimation for when China decides to make its move against Taiwan. If you can spin a narrative that the norm against conquest has begun to recede, if you can further frame that from a Chinese perspective of saying, and this isn't even conquest, this is a police action to reclaim a rebellious province, making reference to the more volatile international environment that Donald Trump's recent actions is something that's a helpful rhetorical move.
In early February, President Trump and Xi Jinping held a phone call, and Xi is reported to have told Trump to be prudent when supplying weapons to Taiwan. Xi reportedly described Taiwan as the most important issue in China-US relations. And this follows a New Year's speech by Xi Jinping, where again he vowed to, quote, reunify China and Taiwan. Can we take that as a sign that Xi Jinping is trying to read the international environment and perhaps he sees that there's been a change in the international commitment to Taiwan?
It's always dangerous to extrapolate from one data point, but your broader intuition, I think, is absolutely correct. That when Xi Jinping looks at the situation in the Taiwan Strait, he'd be asking himself a number of questions. First, what's the balance of military capability? Can I potentially pursue aggression against Taiwan at an acceptable cost? 30 years ago, absolutely not. But in the current period, China has developed a very significant military capability to potentially execute an invasion of Taiwan. I think what is notable about the correspondence between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump is two things. First, he has used this as an opportunity to directly underscore to the Trump administration that he sees the reclamation of Taiwan as a vital interest and that there is a continued frustration at America's supply of arms to Taiwan in apparent defiance of this interest. So he's declaring his own red line there. I think the second element of it, which makes this a particularly ingenious element of diplomatic engagement from Xi Jinping, is that a lot of the time with these kinds of communications, understood that they will eventually reach a wider audience, is that you're not just communicating with the person you're talking to, but you're trying to elicit a response that ideally will undermine Taiwan's confidence in the US commitment. So in reaching out and signaling this is a core Chinese interest, what Xi Jinping is also seeking to do is to test America's resolve to potentially extract some kind of renewed ambiguity or uncertainty or willingness to deal from Donald Trump. That will in turn weaken Taiwanese confidence that America will come to their aid in a time of peril.
Andrew Phillips from the University of Queensland. We also heard today from Soki Tok at the University of Melbourne, China and Taiwan analyst Jessica Drun, who's based in the United States, Mark Harrison from the University of Tasmania, and Mei Feng Kuo at Macquarie University. You'll find all their details on our website. And you've been listening to Rear Vision, broadcast on ABC Radio National, News Radio, Radio Australia, and the CBC in Canada. I'm Anthony Fennell. Thanks for joining me. Until next time, cheers and bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.